Good day and welcome to the podcast, To Be More. I'm your host, TJ Smith. To be more is exactly what we want. We want to be more than some of the problems that we all know exist in our metro area. As our conversations continue, we have to have an obligation to separate fact from fiction. There's no disguising it. Black men and boys in Baltimore, sadly, represent a disproportionate amount of murder and shooting victims, as well as those incarcerated. However, despite the narratives that often pop up on social media, especially chastising Black fathers as absent, that tide has been turning for many years as Black fathers, according to a CDC report, are the most involved fathers with their children. We must look at the reality of civil rights, the Vietnam War, the crack era, and urban centers in America, followed by the war on drugs and mass incarceration as contributors to the broken homes, especially in Black communities. Generation X and beyond are products of many of those parents and have reversed that pattern, but sadly, the stigma is still there. Joining me to discuss the work being done to highlight the role of Black fatherhood are Matt Pressberry, a husband, father, and educator, but also the founder of the Black Fathers Foundation, and Mr. Bobby Marvin Holmes. He's also a father, a husband, and professionally he is licensed social worker and the founder of Son of a Dream, LLC. How are you gentlemen doing today? And thank you for joining me.
Doing well, hey, brother.
Hey, TJ, thanks for the invite.
Appreciate both of you guys, man. Matt, you have to tell me how you started this huge Facebook group, the Black Fathers Foundation, and how many subscribers are you up to?
So we started the Black Fathers group on Facebook in 2008. And coming up now on our 13th anniversary, and we are just a shade under 92,000 members. And it started when I had been doing work previously with fathers, worked in public schools and was running a fatherhood group in there. And when I got on Facebook, saw the opportunity to create something that where I just saw there was a void in terms of Black men being represented for who they truly are. So when I had the opportunity to create this group, I jumped on it, and we've been rolling ever since.
So this sounds like, if I'm not mistaken, 2008 is probably around the time Facebook started becoming mainstream for many people. So you started at the very beginning, and obviously with 92,000 people, it's people from all over the country, if not the world, that are in this group.
Correct. I had first found out about Facebook when it was, I think it was just open to college students or whatever, and I wasn't in college anymore. So yeah, pretty much I had been following since then and jumped on the first chance I got when it really opened up. People on six continents around the world, many of them are stationed in the military and stationed in different countries. We definitely have heavy following on the continent of Africa for sure. But yeah, six continents around the world.
So Bobby, you have Son of a Dream, Reflections of a King. I know you're a filmmaker and an author as well. Tell me a little bit about your organizations.
No problem. So Son of a Dream originally launched in 2008. That was a good year, it sounds like. As a publishing and production company. First project was Hugh Voices. At the time, it was an online magazine looking to cover positive news, inspiring news of Black communities in Baltimore, Washington, D.C. And just over the years, it has grown as I have grown. I have a media background, writing for several local newspapers and also producing for public radio. But as the years, progress, I started working with youth and families, and I fell in love with that work. Son of a Dream, started to offer workshops for youth and families as well. That passion grew, as I did work with youth and families, as well as my work in the community, where I met you, TJ. I eventually sought to get my MSW, my Master's of Social Work, to become a social worker, to be able to do my work in different ways. And that happened in, you know, in 2019. Now, as a licensed social worker, I offer therapy through a local agency. I offer therapy to Black fathers, you know, youth and families in general. But I do serve Black fathers as well. And with Reflection of Kings, that being my program for Black boys in Baltimore, teach them how to use media to tell their own stories.
So you touched on something that I want to get both of you to respond to. Therapy for Black fathers. What is one of the things or one of the issues, obviously not telling us who, but from the Black fathers that you can say is one of the biggest issues, the biggest glaring issue that you might hear from Black fathers?
Men, we have been socialized in this country and in America to, you know, be the quote unquote providers, to, you know, bring home the bread, so to speak, and make sure everything is good on the home front in terms of, you know, rent, mortgage being paid, et cetera. So, you know, with when it comes to fathers, just, you know, security, making sure that everyone is stable, making sure the household is stable, making sure the children are all right and are secure and are doing well. So, you know, really, and I would say it's no different than moms in that regard, but definitely the pressure being on Black fathers. Oftentimes the perception, the stereotype that, you know, Black fathers are invisible and not in the picture, not involved with the children's life. And as you said in the very beginning, the opening, that's just not true. But, you know, fathers still dealing with the stressors of making sure there's, you know, roof over the over top of the children's heads, making sure food on the table, and dealing with the stressors of outside in the society, you know, whether it's at work, dealing with, you know, racism or just the day-to-day stressors of work, or dealing with racism within your community and other communal problems such as violence. So fathers, just like moms, want to provide safety and security for their children. And of course, when they feel like it's compromised or being threatened, you know, stress arises. Then it's a matter of how you deal with stress and how you deal with depression. And we're in a day and age now where mental health is being promoted like never before. And you have more people seeking mental health services. And this is a new frontier, so to speak, as Black men transition and seek support, seek help. Oftentimes, our concerns are being ignored. What does stress look like for us? What does depression look like for us? We have brothers that are walking around and really, TJ, at the core of the anger and the trauma, that there's also depression as well that they're dealing with. And folks don't see it as that. You know, due to misconceptions and stereotypes and just simply, you know, feeling marginalized and ignored in society. But Black fathers, you know, experience these things and need safe spaces as well as they try to navigate this terrain.
Man, you touched on some jewels of things that, you know, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I want to make sure I'm breaking it down properly. You kind of touched on breadwinner, basically, and I want to make sure this is an accurate term. Is it maybe a bit of a feeling of being inadequate, or trying to make sure they're doing it adequately, and sometimes feeling inadequate with handling what they're supposed to handle? Does that sound about right on the front end, along with everything else?
Yeah, you know, TJ, like us all, like I'm sure you and Matt and I know myself, you know, like I said, we've been socialized to attach our sense of self-worth based on our ability to provide.
That's right.
And when that is, you know, comes in question or being threatened, that's a security blanket for us. And, you know, oftentimes there's a term called John Henryism, where, you know, Black men, we operate in a space where we just got to power through no matter what's going on. you know, we just got to power through. No matter what's going on in the community, we got to power through, soldier through, and make it happen. We work ourselves to death.
That is so right. And I often say it now, and it's okay to not be okay. And Matt, I mean, it's a perfect transition because you've been open about some of your struggles with depression and mental health challenges, you know. And if this past year hasn't taught us anything, it's taught us that mental health is fragile. Being stuck in a quarantine and this unprecedented situation. Can you touch on that a little bit? Some of what you've seen, and however comfortable you are talking about your personal situation that I know you've been open about.
Yeah, certainly. I'm definitely open about it. I still, to this day, deal with depression and anxiety. I have attempted to take myself off of this planet before, you know, due to the stressors that I was under and not properly being able to manage and to deal with what I was going through. I've been to therapy off and on, and I'm in therapy currently. And it's really important. I had to get myself back into it because I've told so many other people to do it. And I was starting to realize how much of a hypocrite I was being because I wasn't seeing anybody myself and I'm telling everybody else to go. But it's really critical, especially in this day and age. And I'm glad that we do have the space we have in Black Fathers and that there's a real shift in society to become much more compassionate around the subject, because there is such a stigma. And for so long, people didn't want to admit how prevalent it really is in our communities, in the Black community, and among Black men, because, you know, as Bobby said, we are conditioned to push through. So it's like, first, you got to believe it's even real. You know, you have people around you who still to this day take it lightly. Oh, man, you just this, you just that, you need to go do this and that, and don't really take it as seriously as they should. But there's definitely been a shift in terms of the compassion around it and people really understanding just how, not only just the fact that it's real, but just how much it can impact our lives and really devastate our lives in the way that we are as fathers and, you know, as men to our families. So we got to understand that we have to take the time for ourselves. It's really important. It's hard to do, but you can't do anything for your family when you're dead or when you're in Shepherd Pratt because you went crazy, you know? So it's really important that we take the time and analyze. And even though we know we have to be the provider and we have to do for our families, we also have to provide for ourselves. And if we're not doing right for ourselves, then there's only so much that we can do for others. So that's why I'm really open about it, because I think the only way that we change it is by talking about it. The only way we change is by being open. We can't just wait for an incident to happen or anything like that. We can't keep being scared, because that won't change the stigma that surrounds it.
You know, this has been, I mean, first of all, thank you for being honest and open about it, because it's been such a whisper. And, you know, I talk about it often, and, you know, my former role, I would be at the podium and I would say it, especially in the Black community, we would whisper, y'all know, it was like, you know, so-and-so crazy, you know, family. And now, no, we can't whisper about it. We have to get that person help and not be ashamed. And, you know, on Facebook, I've taken advantage of going into someone's inbox and sliding in their DM to say, take care of yourself, when they say, I'm not doing well, because we don't take care of each other enough. And that means a lot, man, that you are open about it. And it's odd because I actually had a question, and it goes right back to Bobby's point about us as men, as Black men. Can your son or your daughter see you weak? What do you guys think about that to this day, to this moment, right now? can your son or your daughter see you weak? Or do you still have to put on the image that you're going to have everything under control? What do you guys think?
For me, definitely my children can see me weak, vulnerable, whatever you want to call it. I don't want to sit around and just be a weeping willow and make them think I'm just a set that can't get it together. However, I'm not afraid to let them know when I'm going through. They understand, you know, they know about my depression and what I go through. And to me, you know, people always say, oh, I got to stay strong. I got to stay strong. I can't let them see this and that. And to me, the strength is really in the vulnerability and the transparency. It's more a coward to me, in my opinion, to try to hide it, you know. So that's why I'm open with my children. I let them know when things are problematic, and I'll show them that that's life. Everything is not going to be sunshine and roses. You're going to have bad days. You're going to have bad times. So you got to see the ups and the downs.
What about you, Bobby? What do you think?
Absolutely. You know, to Matt's point, what I often, you know, folks will ask me, hey, Bobby, how you doing? And I'll respond with strong. But when I say that, I'm recognizing, just as Matt just said, you know, there's strength and vulnerability. Strong doesn't mean there's nothing wrong with you. Despite the challenges I'm experiencing, I'm still able to push through. And you know, definitely take care of my day-to-day responsibilities, but it doesn't mean that, you know, I'm not affected by stuff. And I believe vulnerability, you know, our children seeing us in that state is very important, right? Because we want to promote and practice taking care of yourself, being transparent about what's going on with you. You know, I have open and honest conversations with my daughter, my 11-year-old, about various things. You know, things she's experiencing, things I've experienced. You know, she read, you know, one of my books that talked about experiences I had in childhood, you know, whether it was, you know, dealing with bullying or whatever. And having that open dialogue with her, you know, made her feel comfortable with, okay, I'm gonna go talk to my dad. I remember, few years back, I just came home after coming from the hospital. My mentee at the time was murdered in 2019. And I came downstairs and, you know, told my wife what happened. I just immediately, you know, broke and started crying. And I think that was the first time my youngest daughter saw me cry. And you know, it was definitely necessary for her to see her father, you know, see her father cry. Not just always seeing, you know, either positive dad or, you know, angry dad, but, you know, dad when he's hurting, dad when he's grieving,
right?
You know. Because it definitely bothered me, and she knows it. I drive around in my car with his obituary in the dashboard. So it's important for our children, you know, if we're setting examples of, you know, being human and at least trying to be healthy, then our children have to see what that looks like.
Right. And I tell you guys from a personal perspective, you know, I did a job in Baltimore as the spokesperson for the police department, delivering the news of so many people, unfortunately, dying at the hands of violence. And then my brother is killed in the city in 2017. And I had to do a press conference, and it was the worst. And let me tell you, I was thinking I was going to be Superman, of course. And I remember getting to that table and reciting it, and it gets me upset thinking about it, and I couldn't hold it together. And when, you know, I go out in public after that, and I would see people and women especially, and they would always comment on, oh, when you cried, that just broke me down. And And it was like, they were so used to me being the stoic guy standing at the podium, of course. And the vulnerability does change you. It opens you up and it does make you more human. And I do think that's something that, I don't know if it's learned behavior or this fictitious image of what we're supposed to be. And I'll say this, when Kobe Bryant passed away, the girl dad thing became a huge thing across, you know, the world. Do we need to do something like that with our boys, though, where not moms being, you know, I have a boy, but dads and their sons in more of a vulnerable place so that they can emotionally be able to express themselves? Do you understand what I'm saying? Where it does, they don't have to have up a guard and a shield with their fathers and feel like it has to be that, you know, bravado. What do you think, Matt?
I definitely follow. Yeah. And I've preached this myself, that we need to get off of this whole idea, boys don't cry and all of that, that goes along with it. And we have to teach our young men to be able to be vulnerable, to be able to express themselves and to not have to hold that in. I'm sure, you know, Bobby could really speak to the effects, and myself also as an educator, you know, what I've seen when our young men are holding in their emotions and they're not allowed to grieve properly, they're not allowed to mourn, and, you know, even just find ways to get out their frustration in a healthy kind of way. And you know, we see what all three of us, you know, have seen over the years, the results of that.
What about you, Bobby? What do you think?
Absolutely. I believe, and, you know, I see it from the perspective of just someone who's worked with youth life, like Max said, over the years. You know, whether elementary, middle school, high school, doesn't matter, where I believe toxic masculinity and hyper masculinity has really, I don't think we fully understand how that has had a negative impact on us as men, and how it has really shaped us. And a very troubling way in terms of how we view ourselves, how we behave, how we interact with others, family, friends, etc., of trying to maintain this facade of what a man's supposed to be. And, you know, I see that it's becoming more of a hot topic in public discourse, and I'm glad it is. And I would say that we do our boys a disservice when we do not give them the space, whether it's, you know, social worker or not. If you care and passionate about the well-being of children, particularly as we talk about now our Black boys, we must provide the space where we give them support. And we must be intentional about teaching what healthy masculinity is and modeling that behavior for them. You know, so many of our young boys suppress what's going on inside, and then they find unhealthy ways to deal with, to cope with the trauma, with the depression. And thinking, okay, if I be as tough as I need to be, you know, navigating my environment, if I let everyone know how big and bad I am, then people will fear me. And based on the trauma and aggression I've experienced throughout my life thus far as a young person, then if I exert this towards others, then I will gain respect. And I believe that plays a factor in the violence that we see in Baltimore. Okay, I got to be the man, I got to be the one to strike fear in the hearts of others, so to speak. And that plays out on how we maintain our relationships. So as men, we have to, like I said, be intentional about teaching our boys what is and what isn't healthy masculinity, and also modeling that behavior for them.
That's, you know, it ties right in, and that's exactly what I was thinking, that that energy has to be exerted somehow. And is that energy part of what comes out in the way of some sort of violence or whatever, or some other bravado, for lack of a better word? And I'm going to transition a little bit and ask about that stigma that we were talking about earlier on about Black fathers being absent. And, you know, while, you know, it is true and factual about the marriage part, and it's not as high in the Black community, but the father involvement is high. And I'll get into some of those numbers a little bit later. Why do you think the stigma still exists? And, you know, that's the first part of the question. The second part of the question, I want to tread a little lightly because I don't want it to be misinterpreted, but I'll ask it this way and I'll explain it more if I need to. But do you think the ladies possibly and inadvertently have kind of stood in the way, maybe because of what they've seen, because the generation prior to ours, our generation, did have to fill the gap? Our generation's kind of stepped up and said, we got it. We're here again. We're back. So why do you think the stigma still exists right now when stats are showing that the Black dads are here and they're involved? What do you guys think, Matt?
I just two things for me, racism and projection. So racism is the obvious one, which is the reason why stereotypes persist, because people of the quote unquote dominant race want to continue to perpetuate this idea for their own benefit, to feel better about where they stand. So that's the main reason why it will continue to go on in that manner, because we in so many ways have made so many strides with social media and all of these things to continue to push out there and to show ourselves and to speak for ourselves and all of that. So when people still believe that it's a problem, it's because they truly want to believe. And then I go into projection, whereas a lot of times people will project whatever their situation is onto others. So if you are a woman and you had a child with somebody and he left and he's no good, he's not taking care of the child, so on and so forth, then in your mind, you can begin to project and say, well, you know, I won't get into the language we so often hear, but men aren't this and men aren't that, we'll say. So you project that onto other people, even if you see, you can see in your community, you can see all these great people, but still just because of the hurt that you're dealing with, you push that out there onto other people. So that's my thought on that.
And Bobby, what about you?
I would have to definitely agree with Matt when we're talking about that stigma. It's a narrative about Black men that's been perpetuated, you know, that's rooted in racism. You know, like a lot of instances where we look at Black criminality, you know, the quote unquote super predator, you know, those type of instances and language that's been perpetuated throughout media and shared in various spaces, whether it's social spaces, political spaces, et cetera, about the Black male identity, who he is and who he isn't. And it's been a constant struggle as Black men wrestle with their own identity and how the world perceives Black men. And, you know, I would just say that I'm grateful that within my life thus far, I had the privilege to, because this is a factor that a lot of folks don't pay attention to. Black men are not only showing up within their families, you know, as fathers, although they may not, in some cases, be with the mother of the child. But they're showing up as fathers, but they're also showing up in community. They're showing up to better their community. You know, that's how Matt and I develop a relationship over the years, the work we've done in community with one another. And, you know, so many others, Darnell Wharton, David Johnson, the list goes on of Black fathers in Baltimore who not only are actively involved in their families, but actively involved in their community. And that is a stark contrast compared to the narrative that is often perpetuated about Black men in Baltimore, who we are and who we are not. And I believe that is a counter, you know, as the examples I just shared is a counter to that narrative of what Black men are doing in Baltimore. Again, not to only strengthen their families, but strengthen their communities. Why? Because they want their families to be safe and they want their families to thrive. So they know in order to do that, they must reach out to the larger community to help make that happen. And that's a narrative that's often not focused on in Baltimore when you're talking about Black fathers. Now, in terms of relationships with the moms, you know, it gets messy and complicated. As you know, is because there's so many variables as to why, you know, relationships, you know, successful and why they aren't. I would say that I push back on the idea that if you're not married or the father is not in the home, that means the family is broken. I push back on that narrative because in my personal experience and my professional experience, I've seen families still make it work and still thrive, although parents aren't living in the same household. Fathers are still showing up, wanting to be in the lives of their children. Black fathers here in Baltimore striving to be in the lives of their children, although dad and mom may not be on the same page. Like I said, it's, you know, there's so many complexities as to why. But I would definitely, I need to uplift what is and what is happening that is often not talked about.
Right. So based on that question I asked you guys, looking at some of the statistics from a CDC report that was released in 2013, so it's a bit dated, but I would imagine based on what we're talking about that these numbers would probably increase if this study was done again today. And this is, again, CDC, a CDC study. And in some of what they looked at were questions that they were asking, if you lived with or didn't live with, how often you ate with your child. And they had different categories. And for Black fathers, that didn't live with their children, 12.6% of the time every day they ate with their child. And in comparison, the next group were, believe, Hispanic fathers, 8.6% of the time, just, and again, every day. And several times a week, it was 30% for Black fathers, and the next group were white men at 20%. So just using that as an example, it just shows you that for this study, it looked like Black fathers were kind of making sure they were at least going to have dinner or lunch or breakfast with their child, even if they didn't live with them. One of the areas that got high marks from Black fathers was playing with their child each week, each day, or several times a week. They got high marks in that area. Bathed and diapered, addressed their child. They got high marks in that area as well. And really soared. And when I say soared, like the highest marks in that bathed, diapered, and dressed area. So looking at that study, it kind of dispels a lot of those myths that are perpetuated. And we know we have work to do and we have some issues in our urban centers, but they come from a lot of history that has taken place. And that's going to allow me to transition into a question. And it's the talk. George Floyd, Freddie Gray, and I don't know the ages of all of you guys' children, but how did you have that conversation? And maybe was it different if you have boys versus girls? And what age and how did that talk sound? Because I had to have it. And you can go ahead, Bobby. How did did you have the George Floyd talk last year with the situation that went down when he was murdered?
I attempted that conversation with my 11-year-old, and she wasn't ready to have it. Within my work with boys, I've had that conversation, and you know, I even had workshops, you know, teaching them what to do, what not to do if stopped by the police. And I believe, I'm of the mind that if you're raising a Black child in America, you know, no matter what's going on, it's imperative to teach them about racism, what it looks like and how it shows up. I think we do our children a disservice when we don't, you know, prepare them, you know, because we prepare them to, okay, I'm gonna teach you how to pay bills. I'm gonna teach you how to shine your shoes, you know, tie a tie, iron your clothes, et cetera. And we say, okay, I'm sending you to school to get a good education so you could get a good job. But for a Black child, you must prepare them for the racism that they may encounter, you know, and more so, affirming their Blackness. Because I believe, you know, that's a part that, you know, needs to be emphasized. Their existence doesn't begin with racism, you know, affirming that Blackness through historical, you know, teaching history and affirming, you know, through cultural rituals and events, et cetera. But having that cultural education, that enrichment is critical as well in affirming who they are. I have a Black daughter, and oftentimes, you know, she watched media that does not, you know, reflect her beauty. So I had to, you know, come up with a mantra early on when she was younger to affirm her hair, to affirm her skin color. Before the conversations with racism, teaching her how to love herself and accept her who she is in the contents, in the context of America and navigating this society. So beyond the talk, and it is essential, I believe as Black parents, Black fathers, mothers, et cetera, it's important for us to promote healthy racial identity. There's plenty of research out there that underscores the benefits of doing so. But I think that's imperative as we raise children in these America.
Yeah. Matt, did you happen to have that conversation about the situation with George Floyd last year?
So our conversation started many, many years ago. It probably even started before Freddie Gray, but that would be the first instance, you know, the first death that I could go back and pinpoint and say for sure. I remember us going through that. And just as Bobby said, you know, you teach your children, Black children, if you are, for lack of a better word, doing it right, you teach them about their Blackness and you keep it real with them every day. So there are incidences that go on all the time where we see these sorts of things happening. So obviously we know it didn't start with George Floyd, even though that was, you know, a real game changer, so to speak. But it started a long time ago, and you just have to let your children know the society that they live in and how things work. So you got to keep it real with them and make them understand the world in which they're living in right now, or at least the country in which they're living in and how things go down. So that conversation started a long time ago. As far as George Floyd specifically, you know, we got a chance. We went to D.C. and saw the artwork in the Black Lives Matter. What's it called? Plaza, I guess. Yeah. You know, we went there and we had a chance to go to Pittsburgh and check out some murals that were painted and all of that sort of stuff. And we actually ran into a few protests going on. So I think that was the main difference. It really went beyond the talk. We've had to talk many times before in the past. And like I said, especially when Freddie Gray was murdered and the subsequent aftermath of that. But I think just going beyond and living in that and seeing the artwork and really getting those feelings and things like that, and then bumping into people going to protests and so on and so forth, I think was an even deeper experience for them than just having the conversation.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's a tough one, and you know, it's a reality. And I want to bring a two-part question for the sake of time, as we get towards the conclusion here. But this was important. This came up a couple years ago. I was actually downtown filming something, and a young man came up to me and asked me a question that was a very difficult question, and I didn't have an answer for him, but I know you guys have the answer. I think you guys have the answer. And I want you guys to answer it based on maybe Matt with the foundation and Bobby, maybe the Center for Urban Families. We know Joe Jones does some fantastic work there, and you've done some work over there, Bobby. So maybe the answer might lie within one of these places. But he was a young man, and his father had done time and was getting out of prison. And he said his father wants to have a relationship with him, and he's nervous, and he doesn't know how to start this thing. Like, you know, this dude's coming home. I don't really know him like that. And he wants to play daddy. How do we start this relationship? You know, that's a real issue. What resources are out there for people, dads, black dads, who are trying to reconnect with their children after they've been away? Maybe they've just gotten clean from being on drugs, whatever it might be. They're trying to reconnect with their kids.
So one thing I could say for sure is our Facebook group, Black Fathers, thing is great in terms of reaching out to people and getting feedback from people who've been through the experience. It's easy for me to say, you know, I could say, give him my own advice from my perspective, but I've never been through it. So I think that would be one that I would definitely recommend, is getting in, being a part of the group, mm-hmm. and seeking some advice. That person could join the group and put up a post on either end, the father, the son, either one, and get advice on how to start, you know, that relationship. For me, you know, what I would think is to recommend to both parties to take it slow, and for the child to understand that it wasn't at all the father's choice not to be around. You know, the father might have possibly made a bad choice that got him in his predicament, but he wasn't just actively choosing not to be there. So the child has to keep that in mind and not hold that, you know, hold that against the father, and give the father a chance. And the father has to understand that he can't just jump into it and expect anything to, can't really expect anything. You just kind of, you know, see where it goes.
Right. Bobby, anything you're familiar with from the Center for Urban Families that helps support something like that?
Absolutely. The Center for Urban Families definitely have a fatherhood program. This particular topic touches home for me. You know, and it's something I've dealt with throughout my career. Where, you know, father's not absent because he's incarcerated, or you know, dealing with drug addiction. My biological father, you know, was in and out of prison most of my young life. I remember, I think it was 2009, if I'm not mistaken, 2012, somewhere along those lines years ago, I'm driving out, you know, to pick up my father from prison. And I'm sitting there in the car waiting for him to come out through those gates and, you know, that's, you know, mind blowing to an extent. Like, you know, here you have son, you know, supporting father as he transitions home. And that relationship has been strained throughout the years and various attempts to, you know, mend it, make it work, bump heads because we have, you know, different personalities, and he's trying to play catch up, you know, for all the years that missed, and sometimes not understanding that he's dealing with an adult now. And I've seen it with boys that I work with. Like, you want to destroy your black boy, you know, you take away his father. And so many of our boys, you know, I've dealt with boys where fathers incarcerated pretty much their entire life. You know, they haven't seen their son. Matter of fact, my mentee who was murdered, his father was released from prison when he probably was a young adult. I want to say he was 19, 20 at the time when his father was released. But his father had been incarcerated his entire life, and probably a little bit over a year of his father being home, my mentee was murdered. Mm. So never had the real opportunity to establish that relationship. But I've seen, you know, working for Baltimore City, you know, DSS, I've seen fathers that maybe battle their addiction, but you best believe they're showing up for visitation with their child on a weekly basis. They engage and they actively trying to kick their addiction, and they feel strongly about, you know, getting their children back. So, you know, I've seen this issue from, you know, various perspectives. And like I said, my personal life and my career. And I would say, you know, definitely to that young brother, it's a journey that has its ups and downs in terms of mending that relationship and just taking it one day at a time.
Yeah. And one I think what Matt said is important, coupled with what your advice is. The support groups of people who've been through it, and then the professional assistance layered with it, because it's uncharted territory. For all intents and purposes, this individual is a stranger. You're now an adult in adulthood and never had an opportunity to have a relationship with this person who is now coming into the environment and wants to forge a relationship. And they have to acclimate back to society. So I think, trying to talk to some people who've experienced it and learn from them is good. And they need to have a, you know, support system, a sponsor, so to speak, similar to NA and AA, because that's really a heck of a place to be in. But thank you guys for that, because that is really important. I want to, before we wrap up, I wanted to do this, and this has been a heavy and deep conversation. I want to end on a bit of a high, hopefully, because there are guys, I do a lot with my son, and through the pandemic, we did a lot of different things outdoors, some that didn't cost a lot of money at all, didn't cost any money. So I wanted to just throw out a little challenge to you guys, and I want to give you a budget. We got a dad who has two kids between ages of 5 and 11, and he wants to go out and enjoy a day on the town with them. We're going to give him a $75 budget. That's a lot of money, actually. We're going to give him $75. What do you think you can build for him? He wants to take his two kids out, and he has this budget. He wants to make a memorable day. Matt, what are you going to have this young man do with his two kids between ages of 5 and 11 in Baltimore?
I mean, there's so many ways to go. What, we're staying in Baltimore, or can he travel?
Well, he could travel. He only has $75, but he can travel. He could travel. All right. Yeah, he could travel.
Right, cool. Well, even if we kept it in Baltimore, the first thing I would think about would be kites. So I would be going to Fort McHenry and taking some kites and fly some kites. And that's really on the cheap. So then the rest of it, you take somewhere. I don't even know what's really good. But let me see, like maybe a Timbuktu, and then you can go get you some crab cakes after that. So, so the kites is really cheap and you save all the money for your food.
Ah, I like it. Ah, some crab cakes. Okay. That sounds very filling and fun. Okay. All right. What you got, Bobby?
TJ, this is too easy, man. You know, we took our kids to the parks before. So this is way too easy for us. Yeah. You know, quarantine, it's even more easier. Last year, during quarantine, I had a Halloween party quarantine with my daughter, where I got a pail of water, put some apples in it. We went bobbing for apples with our bathing suits on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we got some food. We did some painting of some cheap pumpkins. We did some painting of pumpkins and we watched some movies, Netflix. So boom, under a $75 budget. Mm-hmm. Outside of that, hey man, you go to Walmart or dollar store, get you a couple of water guns, and on summer day, have a water gun fight in the park. Get some ice cream, maybe some pizza or something later on, or have a picnic. Too easy, TJ.
Yeah, it is. That's a good deal. You can do a lot with $75
is a heck of a budget. I know. I thought the $75 was too much. I was going to make it even less. Because you know, my son and I did a lot of bike riding last year, again, which is pretty free. If you are close to the subway or the light rail, jump on that, get downtown, ride the bricks. Like you said, grab some pizza, go over to Druido Park or whatever park, any park in Baltimore and in the metro area. My son is one who loves the trains. We just rode the train from wherever we got on to the top, to the bottom, just to do it. And he just loved riding the train. And that was the day. You know, we went fishing a bunch of times and the bait was $4 and change. That was it, you know, and like I said, just take a few things out. But I think what all we just talked about was be creative and it doesn't have to cost any money. And my son is 9 years old. And at 9 years old, one thing that he repeats to me all the time now is, oh, it brings back so many good memories. And he's talking about just last year, but he's already talking about memories. Oh, man. And the memories aren't from how many dollars I spent on them. It's because of the time that was spent with them. So take that to the bank, fellas that are listening. It's all about the time. So we got to budget that time with them. So thank you, guys. This has been great. I really appreciate, the vulnerability, everything that was discussed today. It's going to touch somebody because we have to keep having these conversations to change the tide. So this has been a great topic, great conversation. I truly believe as more of us step up and continue to get involved, we're going to continue to watch that tide turn. And we have to fill these gaps. And, you know, we have to fill them even for those, you know, kids that don't have parents or the parents aren't there. And I want to thank you guys, Matt and Bobby, for being part of this. And thanks to all of you as we aim to be more. And until next time, take care.